Yep, so we're finishing Nehemiah, chapters 12 and 13, finishing the story this morning. Sometimes you read or you see a story or something and you think it's going to be about one thing and it turns out to be about something else. So for example, when I went to see the film Dunkirk recently, you think it's going to be a war film, but it's not a war film. It's kind of a suspense film. It's a thriller in a war setting. Thought Nehemiah was really a story about the rebuilding of the walls, about one man coming in, making a difference, and sorting everyone out, and seeing Jerusalem rebuilt. But it's not. As I read these last two chapters, I thought, got the sense that Nehemiah actually has a story, is more of a tragedy than this great success story. And if you don't believe me, let's have a quick look at how it ends. So I was given chapters 12 and 13. Some of you, probably particularly Jean, will be very pleased to know I'm not going to make anyone read those chapters out. This morning I'm just going to pull out some key sort of verses and sections from those last two chapters. So, how to find the fire escapes and toilet. That was what the temple looked like after Nehemiah had finished. No, that's better. There we go. Thank you. Nehemiah 12. So they finished building the walls and restoring everything to how it should be. So they had a dedication service, a giant dedication service. So starting at chapter 12, verse 27, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived and were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving and with the music of cymbals, harps, and lyres. 31. I had the leaders of Judah go up on top of the wall. It's not an ominous dot, dot, dot there at the end. Chapter, verse 40. The two choirs that gave thanks then took their places in the house of God. So did I, together with half the officials as well as the priests. Eliakim, with their trumpets, and also some other guys. And the choir sang under the direction of Jezrehiah. And on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing, because God had given them great joy. The women and children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem could be heard far away. At that time, men were appointed to be in charge of the storerooms for the contributions, first fruits, and tithes. From the fields around the towns, they were to bring into the storerooms the portions required by the law for the priests and the Levites. For Judah was pleased with the ministering priests and Levites. And then on to chapter 13, verse 1. On that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people. And there it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call a curse down on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. When the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. Okay, so that's where we get to the end of chapter 30. So they've had this big dedication service, and they recommit themselves to the law, to keeping the law, to following God's commands. So fade to black, credits roll. That's where you end the story if you want it to be a kind of success story, if you want it to be a story about triumph over adversity and how one man can make a difference. But it doesn't end there. Chapter 13 goes on. I was not in Jerusalem. So we're going to verse 6. I was not in Jerusalem. This is Nehemiah. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. So Nehemiah has left Jerusalem. He's had been called back to Babylon to serve the king. And just before he said that, in verse 4, he says, Eliashib, the priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah, and he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and olive oil prescribed for the Levites, musicians, and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and musicians responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. So Nehemiah goes away, and when he gets back, he finds out that all kinds of things have been going on. Tobiah, who you may remember from earlier in the book, was an opponent of Nehemiah. He was someone who opposed the work that Nehemiah was trying to do. But again, if you remember from previous sermons, he also had friends in Jerusalem. Tobiah was a powerful man. This Eliashib, the priest, was closely associated with Tobiah, it says. In fact, I think they were related through marriage. The problem is, of course, not only is he an opponent of Nehemiah, he's an Ammonite. And if you remember from what we just read, just previously, the Lord said, don't let the Ammonites into the city and don't let them have a share in the temple or anything like that. And yet when Nehemiah goes, Eliashib, the priest, lets Tobiah into the temple so that he can do business. That's why he's doing it. He's setting up his own rooms and things so that he can trade and do business. Not only that, the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them. So the Levites were one of the tribes of Israel who were like the priests, the priestly caste. And the tithes were set aside to give to the Levites. So they didn't have to work. They could give they didn't have to work their own fields or anything like that. They could give their full attention to serving God, to doing the looking after the temple. So the rest of Israel kind of set aside food and grain and so on to look after them. And those portions had not been given out. So the Levites and the musicians had to go back to their own fields to work and make a living and growing food. On chapter 13, verse 15. In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys, together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. People from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. Moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. So not only had they done those other things, they'd completely forgotten the dedication they'd just made, the commitment they'd just made to keep the law and to honor God's teachings by forgetting about the Sabbath and allowing others to come in and sell on the Sabbath and marrying with sort of pagan races who took their eyes away from God. Nehemiah, when he comes back and finds this, what does he do? Well, he cleans house. He goes through again and he puts all these things right and he sorts out what's going on in the temple, kicks Tobiah out and all those things. But in the last chapter, we find scattered throughout this last chapter, this repeated refrain of Nehemiah. I've pulled them out here from chapter 13. Remember, so he's describing what happened. Every now and then he breaks from what he's describing to put in a little comment like this. Remember me for this, my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. Remember them, my God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Remember me with favor, my God. So it's almost like while Nehemiah is going through this process of tidying up this mess again, he's constantly got the back of his mind this fear, this doubt, that it's all going to go wrong again. And he's essentially saying, God, I tried. Remember that. Remember that at least I tried. Whatever happens, remember me for that. Don't judge me by the people's failures, by their disobedience to you. Don't judge me by the results of what happened, but judge me by the fact that I tried and I intended to do the best I could. So in other words, Nehemiah, you get the sense when you read this last chapter, Nehemiah is not sure that this story is going to have a happy ending. And that, I feel, is almost like the tragic part of it, is you read through the first few 12 chapters and Nehemiah's coming in and he's sorting everything out and he's doing all these amazing things. And by the end of the book, he's kind of saying, well, I can't be sure it's going to last. I can't be sure it's going to hold. And if you know your history, you know that it didn't hold. And it didn't end well. The people of Israel didn't continue to trust God and hold on to God. And 500 years later, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, 70 AD, and the temple. And almost like all this work that Nehemiah had done 500 years previously, gone, forgotten, not worth it. And I feel like when I was reading this, I feel like, man, this should have ended at chapter 12. You know, there would have been so many stories that would have been better if they'd ended a chapter earlier. If they'd ended at chapter 12. I think about Eliashib the priest, who was mentioned here as the guy who gave the room to Tobiah. I recognize the name because in chapter 3, when I last preached on this, he was the high priest who helped build the walls. He was the guy who, with all the other priests, rolled up his sleeves and helped build the walls. And yet, here we're at the end of the book, he's remembered for giving a room to an enemy of Nehemiah and someone who is, by the law, not allowed to be in the temple, let alone for business. So many stories would have been better if they'd finished a chapter earlier. When I was younger, when I was a new Christian, I remember we had this guy came to our church. He was a youth worker, and he's one of these all singing, all dancing, very charismatic, full of energy types of youth workers. And he used to be a drug addict, and he'd been in prison. He became a Christian when he was in prison, and he came out and he was committed to God, doing all his youth work. And it was amazing to watch him go. And then one day he just vanished, dropped off the radar. I remember a little while I saying, "Whatever happened to him?" And they said, I was told, "Oh, you know, he left his wife and ran off with another woman." And you think, man, that story would have been better if it had ended just a bit earlier. But it didn't. We've just had the summer. It's easier, I think, to be a Christian in the summer. Not just because of the weather and the long nights, but because you've got all the festivals, all the things, the camps we've heard about. This is from Big Church Day Out. And when I read about this dedication that they were having, I was kind of in my mind drawing these parallels with these big events we have and we go off to in the summer, like Big Church Day Out and others. And you've got all the people of God gathered saying, yes, amen, we're going to do this, we're going to commit to God. But then Nehemiah goes back to Babylon. And what happens? Does it last? Does it hold? You can go to these places and you hear really good teachers, really good, charismatic, powerful speakers. You spend a lot of time with other Christians. You're surrounded by other Christians. You have great worship services and all those kind of things. It's very easy to be committed to God in that kind of environment. It's not difficult at all. In fact, you stand out if you're not committed to God in that type of environment. I remember one summer when I was at university in London, and this was back in the 90s, and there was the thing going on in London called the March for Jesus. I don't know if you heard of it, where loads of people in London would get together, meet in Hyde Park, I think it was, and we'd march all the way to Trafalgar Square, clogging up the roads, annoying drivers and all kinds of things. And then at Trafalgar Square, we'd have this huge sort of worship service. And I remember when I went on this, and this feeling of like, yeah, this is amazing. You feel invincible. You feel like, yeah, I'm never going to sin again. I'm never going to, turn my back on God again. But then you get away from that and you're back to university and your friends are asking difficult questions and all that kind of thing. It's hard. It's hard to keep up that momentum. And in the summer, you've got the concerts and so on, but the winter comes with the cold weather and the dark nights, and it's hard to keep it up. One of the most common metaphors for the Christian life in the New Testament is that of a kind of an athletic contest of some kind. Paul uses it a lot. He compares it to boxing at one point, but the most common image is the idea of running a race. He says to the Galatians, I fear, you know, the Galatians had been very receptive to him, very kind to him, and they were following him. But some people had come in and distracted them from the gospel, and they were getting focused on keeping the law again. And he says to them, I'm afraid that I've run my race in vain. And he says to them, you were running such a good race. Who cut in on you and stopped you running the race? Paul writes to Timothy, he says, run the race according to the rules. The author of Hebrews, a very well-known verse, says, you know, since we are surrounded by this long history, this long tradition of people who have stood up for God, let us throw off the sin that so easily entangles and run the race. This image of the race, this image of an athletic contest, is often used in the New Testament. I think it's a good image. It's the image of a long-distance race. And it is a good image because it reminds you, you've got to run for 13 chapters, not just 12. It's not enough to just run 12. You've got to run all 13 chapters. Do you know the Greek word? Some of you don't panic. The Greek word that's used to refer to this athletic contest is agon. Here, I was very excited when I found this logo, because it's so unusual to find a sports company with a sort of robust grasp of the Greek language. But here, they've got the Greek hoplite helmet and everything, agon. This is the word that's often used to refer to this contest, this struggle that the Christian life is. And of course, some of you may recognize that word, because what do we do in English? We bung a Y on the end of it. And it means something, agony. But that is where we get the word agony from. This word agon, which means a struggle, a contest. And that's the word Paul uses to describe the Christian walk. Agony, struggle, conflict, wrestling. During those mountaintop moments, those dedication services, it's easy. But in day-to-day life, it's a struggle. It's a contest. And it's no wonder, I think, that we have those moments where we say, you know what, when Nehemiah was here and the walls were up and we were all standing on the wall and the choirs were singing, I believed. But now he's gone and, you know, I need to put food on the table. And Elishab the priest, he's a good friend of Tobiah. It's easy to see why people said, you know what, let's not bother. Let's not bother anymore. It's hard to be an Israelite. It's hard to be one of the people of God. Trying to hold on to the things that God wants you to do in a world that really doesn't want you to do them. But it's also harder to be Nehemiah, I think. He invested so much. We've heard over the previous weeks, months, we've heard about all he invested in the people of Jerusalem. The walls he built so that they could be protected and so that God's temple could be protected. The way he said, no, let's sort this out. Let's get back to how we should be living. Let's make sure the Levites are taken care of so they can run the services which help us in our relationship with God. Let's keep the law. Let's do everything as we should. And the moment his back is turned, it all falls down. All his work is undone. He's got to face that moment of agon, that struggle of saying, I give up, or not saying, I give up. He could say, I tried, you know, well, God, I did my best. So see what thanks I get. Leave them to it. Let them, they can suffer the consequences. But he doesn't. He picks himself up and he goes back and he says, all right, let's try again. Let's try again. I think if you say to me, I am committed to God and I am serving God, but you have never had that moment in your heart where you say, you know what, I really don't know if it's worth it. I would question whether you really have committed everything to God. whether you really have faced that struggle. Thomas Merton said, if you find God with great ease, perhaps it is not God that you have found. And I think there's some truth to that, that it is a struggle to draw near to God, and it is a struggle to be close to him. And it is a struggle, as Nehemiah found, to try and help others draw near to God. When Ruth and I were in Australia, we did a lot of mentoring with young people. And the way it worked in Cornerstone, we were a community, so we lived with them, we worked with them, and they would often come to our house for meals, and we would give a great amount to these young people. And sometimes it didn't work out very well. Sometimes they, for whatever reason, wouldn't respond, or sometimes they would sort of break your heart. That's the only way I can think of putting it. They would break your heart. And that is one of the problems when you open up your life to others, when you make yourself vulnerable to others, is you give them the power to hurt you. And when it happens repeatedly, it can begin to erode this desire in you to actually care and to actually love others. And I think Nehemiah faced that. And you come to this point where you say, I can keep going, or I can just stop loving. I can stop caring. Here's a quote from C.S. Lewis I like. There is no safe investment. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers of and perturbations of love is hell. Absolutely, my experience says this is absolutely true. This is absolutely true. And I've not always done this well. And I'd say one of the biggest struggles for me over the past 2 years or so has been to come out of that environment in Cornerstone, where we were loving others sort of very intentionally and intensely daily, to come out of that and to be willing to take that risk again, to be willing to open my heart to others. I've found that really difficult. I haven't always done that well because I've been scared of going through those moments of pain again. But there's a reason, I think, why Paul uses this analogy of the race, of the struggle. Because he often is sort of putting us in a position where we have to say, we've got to keep our eyes on the prize. We've got to focus on what we're running towards, what we're running for. The Israelites, they quit the race because they gave up. They stopped doing the good things that they had been called to do. That's how they stopped running the race. That's obvious. We've read that. But what isn't obvious, I think, or isn't as obvious, is that Nehemiah also, in his own way, had a choice to stop running the race. But his wasn't in these sort of outward, obvious moments of rebellion against God. His was in the decision to stop caring, to give up, to no longer love. He could have thrown his hands up and walked away, but he didn't. When he came back, he said, let's build it again. Let's rebuild. He doesn't know, as we've heard at the end of the book, he cannot say with confidence that, okay, this is going to have a happy ending. This is going to go well. He cannot say that. He does not know. But he did it anyway. He did not give up. He could have washed his hands of the whole thing and walked away. But he didn't. And in a sense, you may focus on the amazing qualities Nehemiah had as a leader. But it is no good to have a leader who is not persistent, who is not faithful. a leader who quits the first time that things get hard. People can stop running the race by embracing some very obvious sin. Those are the things we know. Those are the things we see. Those are the things we can pray about and challenge others about. But you can also stop running the race by letting your heart grow cold. And outwardly, you look like a good, faithful Christian. You're there every Sunday. You're doing all the right things. You're voting when you should be voting and all those things. But inside, your heart is hard and cold, like C.S. Lewis's quote described. You've locked it away because it's easier and it costs less. And you just don't want to go through the pain. You can't be bothered. But what you have done is you've stopped running the race. Just like all the other people who have done all those obvious, easily condemnable sins, you've given up and stopped running too. It's just no one would know from looking at you. And you may not even realize yourself. And that's the danger. That's the real danger. That is, I am not likely to commit some grand, obvious, terrible crime or sin. I'm too, you know, well-bred for that. But the danger I face almost daily is this temptation to just stop running because I'm tired and because my legs hurt. And it's easy, the easy things, the outward things, they can be the easy things. But what's going on in here? This is the challenge. This is where the agon is, where the struggle is. It doesn't matter why you stop running, you've stopped running. You may not have given to buy a room in your temple. You may not have stopped tithing to the Levites. You may not have married a Moabite. Ruth was a Moabite, according to the Bible. I married a Moabite. You may not have done any of those things, but you've stopped running the race because you've stopped loving others. You've let your heart grow cold. And you've not realized, you stand there and you look at others and say, I can't believe they're doing those things. I can't believe they're doing those terrible things. It's so obvious. Why can't they see their sin? And you are in the same boat because you've given up running too. The title Oz gave me for these two chapters was Whole of Life Worship. What is whole of life worship? It's something I've heard, you may have heard it used before as a kind of a term to talk. What is it? Well, I've got a slide here that I think sums up what whole of life worship means for me. It means simply everything matters. Everything matters. That's what I think it means. Whole of life worship is not, you know, singing worship songs while you jog along to yourself. Though you can include that. It's not, listening, making sure you've got the Bible on your iPod or whatever when you're walking. It can be, that can be a very key component of it. But whole of life worship goes deeper than that. It's about living like everything matters. So Tobiah and the temple, Elishab gives him a room. What's the big deal? It's just a room. It's just a place. Doesn't Tobiah deserve a second chance as well? Shouldn't we, try and welcome him? But it matters. Ephesians 4:27 says, do not give the devil a foothold. Don't give him an inch. Don't give him a single room in your temple. You know, the devil doesn't believe in the Sabbath. He doesn't take any days off. It matters. Does it really matter what I do with my life as a job? Does it matter how I work? Yeah, I know we said something about making sure the Levites were provided for, but, you know, to be honest, they just stand around in the temple not really doing much while I'm in the field working from dawn to dusk. You know, I've got to put food on the table for my children too. Does it really matter? Does it really matter who I marry? We're in love. That's the important thing, right? That's all that matters. Surely. Doesn't really, nothing else matters, does it? Not really. Whole of life worship says everything matters. Those decisions matter. Just in one thing that some, one of the things I did at Cornerstone was I would teach for the course we did. And my view of education, I've never really viewed myself as an educator, more of a kind of, I viewed it as my job to plant bombs in people's heads. That's kind of the way I viewed education. So I would occasionally throw at them challenging quotes and comments just to get them thinking about how seriously they were going to take their faith. For example, when I was trying to get across to them this idea of everything mattering, I would tell them this story about a guy who was a businessman, quite a successful businessman, and he became a Christian. And for a while, he sort of did his business, and he was a Christian and so on. But he had a moment in his life where he felt like God put on his heart the Great Commission, the end of Matthew, where Jesus says, go out into all the world, make disciples of all nations. He felt like God was saying to him, I want you to devote your life to that goal. So he said, okay. And he started living differently. He gave up his business. He started thinking, well, if I want to bring the gospel to others, I really need to think about all those little things. He changed his diet to try and make sure he got sick less, that he had more energy. One time, and this is the thing I used to tell them and see what they thought about it. One time, a group of his friends said, let's go skiing. He said, skiing, that sounds like fun. So, okay, we'll go skiing. And then he went home and he did a bit of research and he found out that the sort of new skiers can be quite likely to have accidents. And he sat down and he thought, well, if I go and I break my leg, what happens? 6 weeks. 6 weeks sitting around unable to get out and do things. And he thought, I can't afford to lose 6 weeks. I'm not going skiing. And I would tell the young people this, say, what do you think of that? And invariably someone would say, no, that's going too far. That's going too far. And you know what? I can't say, you know, totally that I think that wasn't going too far. But you know who that guy was? That guy was Bill Bright, who founded Campus Crusade for Christ, an organization that literally millions of people have heard the gospel because of that commitment. And I think of him and I think, I don't know what I would have done in that situation, but I certainly know I am in no position to judge him for that decision. Because there was a man who took this, everything matters, and lived and ran with it. Another quote I used to throw at my young people, Archbishop William Temple, see what you make of this. Archbishop William Temple, this said, to choose a career for selfish reasons is probably the greatest single sin any young person can commit, for it is the deliberate withdrawal from allegiance to God of the greatest part of time and strength. So he's not saying everyone should become missionaries, everyone should become ministers or anything like that. What he's saying is if you make a decision, work is something, your career is something that will take up the vast majority of your time and headspace. And he's saying if you make a decision about what to do without giving God any thought, without submitting any part of it to God, he says that is the greatest single sin any young person can commit. This was the kind of thing I used to throw at my the people I was teaching, just to see their reactions. But I also have to say, yeah, it matters. Everything matters. What you do with your life matters. Who you marry matters. What job you do matters. These things matter, and to whole of life worship is to live as though these things matter. Ultimately, though, I was trying to think, what was the big problem with the Israelites? Why did they stumble in this way? And I think one of the issues was about this dedication service that they had. I think, ultimately, the issue is not really that they had this dedication service and didn't follow through on it. I think the ultimate issue was that they had this dedication service, but they only had it once. That was, I think, at the heart of the matter. I confess I have a problem with some of the language we evangelicals use when we talk about you become a Christian by asking Jesus into your heart. And I would say to you that if you ask Jesus into your heart sort of 20 years ago, that might make you a Christian, but it doesn't make you a follower of Jesus. Because to be a follower of Jesus, you need to ask Jesus into your heart every single day. You don't just make him Lord of your life for one moment in time. You've got to make him Lord of your life every single second, of every single minute, of every single hour, of every single day. Which is why it is a struggle. Which is why it is hard. And there's nothing wrong with these, the big church day out or the camps or any of those experiences. They can be incredibly important. And these sort of crucial milestones in our faith. But if that is all you have, if those moments are the only times in your life where you commit something to God, you are going to stumble. You are going to fall. Whole of life worship is to remember that everything matters, and we have to build into our lives these dedication services. We have to build them into our lives on a frequent basis, because we don't want a life that does to God what the people of Jerusalem did to Nehemiah. We don't want that. The good news, probably ready for some good news, the good news is that these moments of dedication, you can do them whenever you want, even in the winter. Can you imagine that? Whenever you want. Any moment in the day, any second in your life. You don't need to wait for some special occasion. You don't need to wait for the walls of Jerusalem to be finished. You don't need to wait for Nehemiah to get back from his trip to Babylon. You can go back to chapter 12 any time you want. If you have a chapter 13 moment, you can flip the page back. Just like that, whenever you need to. And God, like Nehemiah, will pick you up and say, okay, let's try again. Let's try again. And God does that for us, no matter how catastrophic we may feel our failure is. No matter how much we feel we may have let him down, God always picks us up, dusts us off, you know, ties our shoelaces for us and says, that's fine. Let's get running again. When you're sitting there this morning, you're not really just sitting there. You know you're running the race this morning. By the way you think, by the way you speak to each other, by what's going on in your heart. Some of us are going well at the moment. Some of us are running well. We are feeling like, yeah, we can do this. We're in a good rhythm. We've got a good pace. We feel like we're making progress. Some of us are struggling. Some of us are limping along, twisted our ankles, something like that. But we're still running. Good on you if that's you this morning. Fantastic. Some of us are getting really tired. And we're looking to the left, we're looking to the right, and we're looking at the crowd, the spectators. And they're sitting there, they've got their cool drink, and they're just laughing and taking photos. And we think, why am I should be in there, I want to be in there. Some of us are just tempted at this moment to throw the whole thing, put our running shoes on eBay, and just quit. And you know what? There's quite a few of us here. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some of us here who have quit, who are just going through the motions, coming to church, maybe getting something from it, maybe enjoying it, but our heart has gone cold. And we don't realize we stopped running a long time ago. We've sat down by the side of the track. God is faithfully calling us to finish the race. It doesn't matter how far back you go. You may be a slow runner. You think, I can't catch up with all those people. Don't worry about that. You may have stopped a while ago. God still patiently, lovingly calls us, finish the race. Tomorrow is a new day. Every morning you can wake up, you can look in the mirror, and you can see the face of someone who is deeply loved by God. And you can make a decision today that morning, you say, today I am going to run the race and I'm going to run well. Let's pray together. Father, I am thankful for your patience with us. And it's a patience, a long suffering that's not, because you're putting up with us, but because you love us. You desire the best for us. And you know that sometimes we need an arm around the shoulders. We need encouragement. We need to be loved back into the race. So I pray this morning, Lord, for any here who have not realized that they've let their hearts grow cold. They've locked them away. I pray, Father, that you might graciously show them that that's what's happened. And with all the joy and celebration that Jesus tells about in the parables in Luke 15, that you might call them back to run the race. Father, for those of us who are running but are tired or weary and not sure whether it's worth it, Father, give us a glimpse of the finish line. Give us a glimpse of how far we've come. Something, Father, to keep us moving towards you. And Father, for those of us who are running well, who are currently finding you a source of joy and excitement, I pray that you may help us to look around and encourage each other on this race. And don't let us slip into that sin of thinking, well, I'm going well. What does it matter what's going on with other people? Father, let us be like Nehemiah, who committed to you and to the people of Jerusalem, and even when they broke his heart, still loved them, recommitted to them, encouraged them to head to you, not knowing whether they would be faithful, not knowing whether they would follow through, but doing it just because it is what you do for us. Amen.